Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Congress is back in Washington. Already they have tried and failed to come to an agreement on funding to combat the Zika virus. President Obama has stepped in to steer congressional leaders towards a solution.
Well, the fiscal year ends on September 30th, and the small amount of emergency funds earmarked for Zika research is about to run out. CDC Director Tom Friedman is extremely concerned, and he's warning that necessary research is going to grind to a halt without more funding. And he believes this particular outbreak could last well into next year without further intervention. Still no known cure and no vaccine ready for consumption.
The president has asked for $1.1 billion from Congress for both research and prevention. Zika poses the greatest risk for babies whose mothers are infected during pregnancy. Women exposed to Zika during the first trimester appear to have experienced the worst impact in their offspring. We need good science to confront this outbreak, Margaret. In the meantime, virus continues to spread.
And there are other health issues on the docket this fall. A House committee is taking up the Mental Health First Aid Act. Now, this is an interesting approach to addressing the large unmet need in mental health interventions in the U.S. And this bill would authorize the government to give grants to states and to communities to equip residents with skills that can help others in a mental health crisis, give them some tools to de-escalate an episode. Often when a patient is experiencing bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, things can quickly get out of hand.
I'm reminded of our recent conversation with Paul Gianfrido, the president of Mental Health America, Margaret, who said, unfortunately, these issues often end up being mediated by law enforcement when a mental health intervention is really required. It's good to see the discussion is at least starting, addressing the gap in access to the right mental health services at the right time. Long overdue.
Well, overhauling healthcare in America is the topic we're looking into today, Mark. Our guest, Dr. Vikas Sani, is president of the Lown Institute, which seeks to transform the culture of medicine and build a healthcare system that is affordable, effective, personal, and just. He's a very interesting thought leader on this trend towards high-value care, and we look forward to that conversation, Mark.
Laurie Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Vikas Sani in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Lawmakers in Florida, ground zero for the Zika outbreak in the continental U.S., are urging the Department of Health and Human Services to allow the introduction of genetically modified mosquitoes into the region. The mosquitoes have been modified to produce offspring that die before reaching maturity and therefore the ability to mate. Studies in Brazil and other countries hard hit by Zika have shown the process reduces the mosquito population by as much as 90%. HHS is examining the request. In a dramatic move impacting tens of millions of consumers, the Food and Drug Administration has issued a ban on the use of antibacterial agents in all soaps, citing mounting health concerns from prolonged exposure. The FDA has ordered the chemical triclosan and 19 other chemicals from all soaps by next year. The FDA statement issuing guidelines saying washing with soap and water is sufficient protection against most germs and disease. They also warn these soon-to-be-banned chemicals bring more possible harm, and not just to users. Studies have shown increased use of antibacterial products have led to strains of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Good news on the teen pregnancy front. Teen pregnancies have seen a dramatic drop in recent years, 36% from 2007 to 2011. Researchers from the Guttmacher Institute and Columbia University have found improvement on contraceptive use accounted for the entire reduced risk of pregnancy over the five-year period. The study's lead author says teens aren't having less sex, just getting better contraception protection. Another recent study showed teens who watched the reality TV series 16 and Pregnant reacted so strongly to the messages from the shows showing teens going through pregnancy and child rearing while their peers were able to go about their normal lives that it had a direct influence as well. And Colorado's teen pregnancy rate dropped dramatically, almost 50%, after a program made long-term contraceptives available for free to all young young women in Colorado who sought the assistance. Public health officials around the country are seeking to replicate the success of Colorado's LARC program. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Vikka Sanni, president of the Lown Institute, which seeks to transform the culture of medicine and to build a healthcare system that's affordable, effective, personal, and just. Dr. Sanni is board certified in cardiology, internal medicine, entrepreneur as well. He's co-founder of Aspect Medical System, the first consciousness monitoring technology for the OR. He was founding partner of cardiovascular specialist and was the founding chairman of the CAPE Physicians, delivering affordable care in non-clinical settings. Dr. Sanni convened the first avoidable care conference, which led to the launch of Right Care Alliance. He earned his bachelor's in philosophy from Princeton, his medical degree from Dalhousie Medical College in Halifax, and did his residency at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Sanni, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
So we're very interested in the Institute, founded by Dr. Bernard Lown, founded the Institute on the basic premise that providers had a responsibility to advocate for better care for their patients. He's also co-founder of the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, which saw nuclear proliferation as a significant public health threat. A good friend of ours, a former guest, Dr. Jack Geiger, was also a founding member. I wonder if you could talk about his impact, the founding principles of the Institute, and how the mission has evolved in the 21st century.
So Dr. Lown is a remarkable clinician, and one of the things that struck all of us who encountered him was his incredible ability to connect with his patients and develop the kind of relationship that allows you to navigate very complicated care delivery systems. He's, I think, the inspiration for the saying that, you know, we aspire to do as much as possible for the patient and as little as possible to the patient. Dr. Lown, you know, led the team that developed the first working defibrillator. He developed one of the first coronary care units. You know, is no stranger to technology, as none of us are in cardiology or in modern medicine as a whole. But he started feeling more and more that things were not quite right with the rates at which we were doing things to patients. The rates of surgery seemed inordinate to him. And he had the courage to actually begin doing some studies to show that we can do really well taking care of patients and using surgery and interventions of various sorts as a last resort, focusing more on medicine, on prevention, on diet, on psychosocial stress. And he was a pioneer in thinking that way. You know, in the last 20 to 30 years, the data as it's grown has confirmed the general wisdom of that approach. So the Lown Institute now is focused on we can do a lot more by doing less. And, you know, the healthcare system is a complicated Rube Goldberg machine, pretty dysfunctional. And all it takes is a stint of being a patient to really begin to experience that. And fundamentally, in that sense, it's really sort of betraying its promise and the humanitarian mission that all of us, you know, professionals signed up for and deep in our hearts really continue to want to do. And it's getting harder and harder to do that.
Well, Dr. Sanni, the Lown Institute vision really does speak, as you just said, to the heart of why most of us engage in healthcare. And I want to read the mission statement, which is that it's to seek a society where health and healthcare are seen as rights, where physicians and nurses serve as healers and as advocates for those most in need of care, where patients are safe from harm, and where spending on healthcare exists for the benefit of patients and nations. One that will probably keep us all pretty working hard for a long time to realize some of those ideals, because we still see healthcare too often as a privilege and not a right. The cost for people are a burden. We talk a lot on our show about medical errors as the third leading cause of death, and providers who wish to simply be the best healer they can be have to deal with a whole lot that seems outside that domain in terms of regulations and inefficiencies in the system. What's the approach and what are the actions that you want to take to tackle some of these very big challenges in healthcare?
Our view is that that kind of social movement needs to be both within the healthcare system, but also outside the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. You know, we think there are a lot of areas where there's system redesign, there's financing redesign, you know, there are new models for delivery of care. But all those changes are being driven primarily top-down. I don't think there's been enough input from rank and file. So one part of what we're doing is building the Right Care Alliance across professions. So it's interprofessional with regard to healthcare, doctors, nurses, you know, pharmacists. Within healthcare, you know, we have some councils that are looking at specific areas like children's health. We're looking at surgery, for example. We're looking at behavioral health. And in each of those areas, we've now convened groups of people who are talking together and developing their ideas for what would constitute what we're calling the Right Care Top 10. So it's an attempt to create a list that would allow people to both imagine what could really be better in the system that rank and file people can see as possible. And our view is that's one way of beginning to elaborate a vision in some detail. And then as a body, as a movement, we think that that kind of vision is something that people will want to participate in, want to promote, advocate for, and then begin a process of demanding change for that. It also is going to take people from outside of healthcare because in many ways the system is very entrenched. The money flows are huge, habits die hard, and we believe some sort of external pressure is needed. So in our vision, the Right Care Alliance is an opportunity to build a network that would have local presence and begin to take on issues that are both local as well as national. The second thing we're doing is we're actually promoting something called Right Care Action Week. You know, there's a website, rightcareactionweek.org. We're having people do things to make visible both what good health care is or could be, as well as call out things that shouldn't be. The theme this year is listening, and that's a stepping stone to action as a way of defining what kind of change we should push for and advocate for.
Dr. Hassani, it's been estimated that about $900 billion worth of Americans' annual health spending budget of $3.5 trillion is considered wasted spending. In 2012, you and your colleague Shannon Brownlee convened the first Avoiding Avoidable Care Conference. Talk to our listeners about that initial conference. What were the results?
After I read Shannon's book, Overtreated, I began to realize that it was really and truly a systemic problem. And so when I called her up, you know, I said, this is a fantastic book. You don't know the half of it in cardiology. I could tell you a lot more. She said, oh, yeah, I kind of get a lot of hate mail because of what I've done. I got lots of loving responses when I was praising every new drug because it's all part of the system of selling hope and innovation and all of that. And we decided to put on the conference, and I imagined we would invite, you know, 30 or 40 people, mostly her contacts. And I thought we'd get 10 or 15, and we'd have a symposium in an afternoon and, you know, talk things out, brainstorm, and maybe something would come out of it. By the time, you know, we were coming to the day of the conference, funders had stepped up. It morphed into a two-day conference. We had to stop inviting people. It was invitation only. We had to stop inviting people at about 120. We actually had about 160 over the 2 days. And the atmosphere was just remarkable. It was just sort of remarkable. I don't know how else to put it. I didn't expect it, really. People came up to us afterwards and said, you know, thank God. This reminded me of why I went into medicine. Or they'd say, you know, this is the best conference I've been to in 10 years. And we were looking at each other thinking, oh, my God, we have hit a nerve. Mm-hmm. And I think clearly what people were reacting to was not just the technical side of how you make decisions, you know, what's the evidence for this technology or that. No, I think people were reacting to the kind of moral argument and the kind of call for moral renewal, really. And it was just quite remarkable. And that's been, I think, what we've encountered as we talk to people. When we frame it less about bean counting and money, and when we think about this as what it does to patients, the waste is, you know, wasted money, but it's also excess harm. And between those two things, you know, the money could be spent covering lots of people who don't have health care. It could be spent, you know, funding primary care, funding neighborhood care, funding home visits. And, you know, patients would be better off. They'd have a better experience.
Well, Dr. Sani, I think you've really tapped into a vein of moral outrage. You know, if you bring together a couple of those concepts and a sense of people's own common sense kicking in, their sense of fairness about what's reasonable. And of course, we saw this played out on the front pages in recent weeks with the cost of the EpiPen. Every once in a while, something comes along which all of America can relate to. You have parents sending their kids back to school who know they have to provide that EpiPen, and suddenly they're paying hundreds of dollars, you know, essentially for adrenaline, a drug that we've, you know, had around for a long time. And people are outraged, but are they going to not get their kid back to school? Of course not. And then we see solutions like the pharmacy companies pricing one version of it at $500, but another version a couple of hundred dollars less. And I wonder, how is the Lown Institute addressing specifically the pricing issues in pharmaceuticals? Because it seems to be one where people feel kind of held hostage.
Well, that's because they are being held hostage, right. I think. I mean, I think the reality is the cost of drugs are through the roof. I recall that for every new cancer drug that came on the market last year, I think the cost was something like $120,000, $130,000 for a year's worth of treatment. And if that bought you a cure or, you know, year or two of life, that'd be something. But the reality is many of these drugs just don't work. And quite often, the ones that do work, work very modestly. So there's a real mismatch between the pricing and the actual benefit. But besides that, I think when you have a system that's driven primarily by whatever the market can bear, you know, with regard to the EpiPen, for example, companies do what companies do. The job, by the way, is not to help people. The job is to make money. They're responsible for their shareholders. So our view about how to check that is really that, you know, everybody's been getting bigger. Pharma companies have been getting bigger. And then hospital systems are getting bigger to compete with insurance companies who are getting bigger. Government's also a big player, but I think for most people in America today, it's fair to say most don't really feel the government on their side. So we don't, you know, we don't have a policy position at the moment on a specific piece of legislation or anything like that. That's not who we are. Who we are activists who want people to come together so that they're well informed about what the problems are and can begin to create some of the solutions and co-create some of the solutions in partnership with each other. If that's a movement that's big enough and large enough, then the kinds of pricing things we're seeing in the darkness won't be able to happen, because it'll be more than outrage. It'll be organized action and organized ability to influence results.
We're speaking today with Dr. Vikas Sani, board-certified cardiologist and president of the Lown Institute, an organization dedicated to improving health and healthcare by building a grassroots coalition of health professionals and individuals committed to transforming healthcare systems and improving the health of communities. You were talking about the drugs that don't work or work modestly, and I was thinking about sort of evidence-based research that helps us find this out, but then I happened to catch Dr. John Ioannidis' lecture, I think, at the Lown Institute on evidence-based medicine being hijacked. I was sort of interested in your thought of, well, we're going to get these activists together. They're going to come. They're informed. They're come up with solutions. But, you know, it was a pretty depressing talk that he gave, because he sort of walked through how all of this evidence that we have out there has been, you know, taken right from people who have self-interest. So how do you cut through all of that and lay out really clearly and honestly to the public, here are the right solutions and here's the evidence behind them? It seems to be an enormous challenge in that context.
It is. So let me make a confession. As a practicing clinician, you know, when I had left academia and I was just in community practice, and, you know, you're really busy and you're trying to do the best you can, and a new drug comes out and you read the paper in the New England Journal, you read the abstract, but you don't go over that with a fine-tooth comb. Mm-hmm. I was influenced, you know, so as I spent more time to go back and investigate, you know, I'm realizing that a lot of that, what passed for evidence, was really skewed. So I think it would be dishonest to say that, you know, we can just check the literature, we can figure out what's right, somehow we'll have good care. Sadly, that's really not sufficient. I'm increasingly recognizing that the way we generate evidence, that has to be reexamined. Mm-hmm. And I think the American public needs to understand that a lot of what gets ballyhooed is hype for lots of reasons. Money, one of them. You know, people want to make a name, you want a career, your hospital wants to stand out against the other hospital. Mm-hmm. So all of that plays in to the media and marketing machine. I think when it comes to the generation of evidence, there's a mismatch between when companies take risk and when they get approvals. A lot of companies sponsor the large pivotal clinical trials and reap the rewards. But much of the risk is much earlier. That risk is in the basic research and in the early stages in the phase one and all of that. In some ways, I think we need to reorganize how we fund healthcare. My own view is it would make a lot of sense if the pivotal trial that determines whether something's going to be a blockbuster or not, that is interpreted by and reported by people who don't stand to make mm-hmm. millions or hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. I don't think the way we're doing it now really allows us to know exactly what is the best evidence. The idea that the public interest is somehow served by unfettered innovation where, you know, the designer and the judge of whether it works and the setting of the price and all of that's kind of held in on one side of the ledger doesn't make sense.
We did a one-year randomized clinical trial on e-consults in cardiology, and the data showed that 70% of the time the academic cardiologist got back to the primary care provider and said, you know, you can manage that at your site and I can help you. And 30% of the time said they needed to come and see them. And I'm not sure you're keeping track of the e-consult movement, but our good friends, Dr. Mitch Katz and Dr. Hal Yee, were doing it on the West Coast. We were the first folks who did randomized trial on it. And with the population that we care for, whom neither insurance works for them in getting specialty care, nor does transportation.
Yeah. In Dr. Lown's practice, a lot of people came for second opinions. In a few studies, something like 80% of the people who'd been told you need surgery were managed medically. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a self-selected population. Sure. It's not a randomized trial, but it just shows you something pretty phenomenal. And then a small fraction was, oh, yeah, you absolutely need surgery. And as I like to say, when a lounge doctor tells you you need surgery,
you really need surgery.
So based on that, we were approached by some large national chains who wanted to do electronic second opinions. And I probably missed the boat, but it just seemed, you know, in our field, in our experience, there's so much in the nuance, in the relationship, in the conversation. And I just wasn't sure that having somebody, you know, 1,000 miles away was going to capture everything. And I guess I'm too old-fashioned, but not surprised that you guys got the results you got.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Vikas Sani, cardiologist, innovator, and president of the Lown Institute, which seeks to transform the culture of medicine and to build a healthcare system that is affordable, effective, personal, and just. You can learn more about their work by going to LownInstitute.org or RightCareAlliance.org. Dr. Sani, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In an NBC News presidential forum on military issues, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton made inaccurate claims about each other's stances on the Veterans Health Administration. Clinton said she would not let the VA be privatized and said that Trump supported doing just that. But Trump hasn't supported the complete privatization of the VA healthcare system. Trump's campaign published a veterans plan on its website last October. One of the biggest changes that plan would make is allowing veterans to get care at any non-VA medical center that accepts Medicare. That would go further than current programs that allow veterans to access care outside of the VA under certain circumstances, such as when the VA medical centers can't provide services or can't do so in a certain time frame. Trump again stuck with the idea of allowing veterans to choose between public and private hospitals in his most recent veterans plan released in July. Giving veterans a choice isn't the same as complete privatization. But Trump twisted Clinton's words, too, when he claimed that she had said the vets are being treated, quote, essentially just fine, there's no real problem. Clinton, in the October 23, 2015 interview on MSNBC, said the problems in the Department of Veterans Affairs were not as widespread as some Republican supporters of privatization of the VA claim. But she went on to acknowledge problems in the VA system, including the issue of wait times for doctors and what she would do to address them. Trump cherry-picked part of Clinton's response in that interview. In fact, the Clinton campaign website says Clinton wants to, quote, fundamentally reform veterans' health care to ensure access to timely and high-quality care. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Diabetes is a chronic illness for which behavioral choices such as diet and exercise are extremely important. But incentivizing behavior change in large patient populations is very challenging. A recent study done by Emory University, Northwestern University, and a nonprofit organization focused on improving the health of India's population of close to a billion people found that text messages sent through smartphones might be a powerful tool in promoting diabetes prevention behaviors. They partnered with India's leading provider of mobile phones, Nokia, to harness a research cohort of a million clients to receive diabetes prevention text messages.
So we wanted to use text messages in multiple languages to influence behavior change. So the text messages themselves were developed with Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health because we wanted them based on science and behavior change theory. And then we adapted them with lots of consumer feedback.
Nalini Saligram, CEO of the Arogya Foundation, says the prevalence of diabetes for those of Indian descent is dramatically higher, four times higher than those in Western populations. The text messaging study was designed to generate improved activity around four simple goals: consume more fruits and vegetables, avoid fried foods, and exercise regularly.
You know, the messages themselves were quite simple, but the sequence of the messages and how frequently they were texted was all based on behavior change theory as well as on Nokia's experience from their consumer base. So we ended up sending it twice a week for 6 months.
After a six-month trial period, researchers saw some promising results. Participants who received just two text messages per week, reminding them to keep their diet and exercise goals, showed an average 40% more compliance with those activities than those who did not receive the messages. Dr. Saligram says it could prove a useful tool for clinicians trying to affect behavior change across large patient populations and across a variety of chronic illnesses. A low-cost, targeted text messaging system sent directly to consumers, reminding them of the power they have to maintain simple lifestyle changes that can improve their chances of preventing or better managing diabetes and other chronic illnesses linked to lifestyle. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.